It's a global supply chain crisis. Containers loaded imports have been at the terminals 9 days or longer.
Supply chain issues continue. It's Thursday, December 2nd, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Chris Cascio in Washington. Find us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, searching for a cure for AIDS, examining the Islamic State's origins, lost shipwreck science expedition. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Supply chain snarls continue to delay imports from Asia, and those delays are mirrored for exporters shipping goods to Asia. T.T. Tran reports from Southern California.
The Port of Long Beach and Port of Los Angeles are the two largest container ports in the United States. Supply chain disruptions caused by COVID-19 and rebounding consumer demand mean there are more goods coming into the U.S. than this port can handle. Even operating close to 24/7, there are sometimes more than 70 ships at anchor waiting to be unloaded.
It's a global supply chain crisis. Containers loaded imports have been at the terminals 9 days or longer. We have a real capacity issue. It's not just a carrier issue. It's an issue involving all stakeholders, you know, the truckers, the warehouses, port authorities, of course, and marine terminal operators.
The port's problems ripple far inland to California farms that ship products to Asian consumers.
Once we fell behind on the port, then it's all been a snowball effect.
Jasmine Vineyards grows 12 varieties of table grapes, one of the state's top agricultural exports. Of the 10 biggest markets for California table grapes, 6 are in Asia. Before pandemic, Jasmine Vineyard shipped 300 to 350 grape field containers a year to Asia during July to October harvest. This year, the vineyard shipped less than 10% of that. For each container not shipped, the vineyard loses $45,000 in profits. Katsurayama figures that $15 to $20 million lost to pandemic-related logistics problems this year. Part of the challenge for exporters is meeting demand. Consumers shop online 24/7, but producers can't produce 24/7, and few links in the supply chain operate round the clock. Didi Chun for VOA News.
Find more on our top story by following our Twitter stream at VOA Asia. We're also on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the VOAnews.com website. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. Despite variants, Singapore's COVID-19 strategy on track. U.S. and South Korea updating war plans for North Korea. Unique effort reopens girls' schools in an Afghan province. Taliban demand unfreezing Afghan assets in positive talks with the U.S. Experts say China's stance in Indo-Pacific added realism to five-nation naval drill. Find complete coverage on all these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and on the VOAnews.com website. We're glad you're with us on VOA Asia on this Thursday. On December 1st, many mark World AIDS Day to show support for those living with HIV and to commemorate those who have died from an AIDS-related illness. Treatments have come a long way for those infected with HIV, but a cure is still elusive. VOA's Laurel Bowman has our story.
Globally, around 38 million people are living with HIV. Since the virus was identified in 1984, more than 36 million people have died of HIV or AIDS-related illnesses. Each year on December 1st, World AIDS Day, many reflect on the fight against one of history's most destructive pandemics. Dr. Chloe Orkin has long studied HIV and is a professor at Queen Mary University of London.
The state of affairs globally is very much a situation of the haves and the have-nots.
Experts say that effective treatment prevents HIV-infected people from transmitting the virus. They also say that worldwide, more than 50% of those living with HIV are women, and that 1.3 million women with HIV will become pregnant. Effective treatment can prevent transmission of the virus to the unborn child. Britain's Dr. Orkin led a global effort to develop the first long-acting HIV treatment. She says that treatments such as injectables taken once every 2 months are available.
But where I live, it could amount to 6 treatment days a year for someone with HIV. And that's very different from having to take treatment 365 days a year. So it's a real breakthrough.
U.S. researchers are chasing a cure by studying HIV patients whose immune systems fight HIV without medication. In Boston, Dr. Bruce Walker is a physician and scientist who has studied HIV patients for 4 decades.
Some people are able to keep HIV in check with their own immune systems, and that really set us off in the direction of trying to understand how that was possible.
Lorreen Willenberg is one such patient. She was diagnosed as HIV positive in 1992, but has never been symptomatic.
29 and a half years, I have never needed to take HIV medications. I'm humbled. I'm grateful.
Dr. Walker and his colleagues at the Ragon Institute do think it will be possible to one day cure those infected with HIV.
Our goal is to train their immune system to develop this kind of super function that we see in some rare individuals to actually be able to ideally cure them of their HIV infection, or at the very least, be able to keep the virus so under control that it can't cause any disease in the person and that it can't be transmitted to somebody else.
But World AIDS Day reminds us that HIV hasn't gone away. With funding and attention now focused on the COVID-19 pandemic, testing for HIV is down and trials have been disrupted, developments that are worrying HIV specialists and those with the disease. Laurel Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
Still to come on VOA Asia, investigating the roots of the Islamic State terror group. Happening now in Asia, thousands of demonstrators continue to protest in Bangladesh, demanding that the government allow ailing former Prime Minister Khaleda Zia, archrival of Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, to fly abroad for medical treatment. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Continuing now with VOA Asia, the Islamic State has affiliates throughout Southeast Asia, mainly in Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines. The rise and fall of the Islamic State's self-styled caliphate were preceded by several factors that contributed to the emergence of the terror group. VOA's Sirwan Kejo reports on the Islamic State's roots in Iraq and Syria.
In June 2014, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, then leader of the Islamic State group, declared its so-called caliphate from this mosque in the Iraqi city Mosul. The declaration came after rapid advances against Iraqi security forces in parts of north and west of Iraq. Prior to that, IS militants had taken over major cities in eastern Syria, including Raqqa, which was the group's de facto capital in Syria. In the years following the U.S. war on Iraq in 2003, corruption, political instability, and sectarian tensions between Shia and Sunni Muslims challenged Iraq's government. These factors, coupled with a complicated civil war in Syria, contributed to the emergence of IS, analysts say.
There was, of course, the security vacuum, the lack of professionalism amongst the security forces. Also, this rapid corruption within the military apparatus and the security apparatus in Iraq. So all of that led to circumstances that any kind of armed group, not even necessarily a group like ISIS or the Islamic State or the groups that were prior to the Islamic State, like Jihad with Tawheed and other groups, and Al-Qaeda in general, any armed groups, basically any gang even, with their ideal circumstances for them to operate.
In a conflict-ridden country like Iraq, experts say corruption doesn't only damage the economy. Rather, it's a matter of national security because it allows for a terrorist group like IS to emerge and grow rich on the one hand.
On the other, corruption also delegitimizes the government, the security forces, creates grievances with the local community, and therefore the local government and the local security forces lose legitimacy in the eyes of the citizenry.
U.S.-backed forces in Iraq and Syria have recaptured nearly all the territory once controlled by IS, including both Mosul and Raqqa. Al-Baghdadi was killed in a U.S. strike in 2019, and thousands of IS fighters are now in the custody of U.S. partners in Iraq and Syria. However, since its official military defeat in March 2018, the militant group remains active by waging deadly attacks in both countries. Experts say if the same conditions that led to the rise of IS in 2014 are met again, the extremist group could reemerge.
The main lesson from ISIS, both its emergence and its defeat, is to not allow for such vacuum to ever exist again, and to maintain the pressure on ISIS for them to never be able to recuperate to the degree where they are able to capitalize on such vacuums that conflicts, both political conflicts, economic conflict, perhaps ethnic and sectarian tensions, would create in both Syria and Iraq.
Some argue those conditions are still present, with instability continuing in Iraq and no end in sight for Syria's civil war. Sirwan Kejo, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks for listening to VOA Asia. An expedition to find lost shipwrecks on Australia's Great Barrier Reef is underway. The voyage is part of the Great Reef Census, one of the world's largest marine citizen science projects. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Conservationists estimate there are up to 900 shipwrecks on the Great Barrier Reef, but only 150 have been found. Shallow water in some parts of the reef off northeastern Australia and the region's susceptibility to storms and cyclones have made seafaring perilous. Volunteers discovered three shipwrecks last year while surveying the world's largest coral system. The expedition, which ends December 1, is returning to five reefs and the Great Detached Reef, remote regions that are rarely visited, to gather more data and hunt for other wrecks. On board the boat are conservationists, scientists and a marine archaeologist. Andy Ridley, the chief executive of Citizens of the Great Barrier Reef, the organisation that runs the survey, says last year's discovery was an unforgettable experience.
The first mate on the boat was floating over the top of a reef from one side to the other and noticed that there were river stones in the water. And, you know, round stones on the top of a coral reef is unusual. I think, you know, we realised it was ballast from an old ship. We discovered one of what we think is three 200-year-old wrecks on that particular reef in the far northern end of the Great Barrier Reef. It's kind of one of the most exciting things I've ever done in my entire life. It's like one of those kind of boyhood kind of dreams.
The Great Barrier Reef is a World Heritage Area. It stretches for 2,300 kilometres down northeastern Australia and is the size of Germany. It comprises 3,000 individual reefs, is home to 10% of the world's fish species, and is the only living thing visible from space. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
That's all the time we have on VOA Asia. Make sure to find us on Facebook, VOA Asia, on Twitter at VOA Asia, and on Instagram, YouTube, and at voanews.com. Thanks to our service chief, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team of Jim Stevenson, Keith Lane, and Jessica Stone. I'm Chris Gascaio in Washington. Enjoy the day.